Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the announcement today by Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy that he is retiring, giving President Trump another opportunity to nominate a far-right replacement like Neil Gorsuch, increasing the court's conservative majority to a 6-3 margin from the current 5-4 split. A former law clerk to Justice Kennedy on the U.S. Supreme Court, Nancy Combs, a professor of law and director of the Human Security Law Center at William & Mary Law School, joins us to discuss how, without Kennedy, there will not be a swing vote, since the reliably conservative Kennedy voted with the liberal minority in support of abortion rights, same-sex marriage, and affirmative action. And with Senate Minority Leader Schumer commenting that Kennedy's departure creates, quote, the most important Supreme Court vacancy for this country in at least a generation, we will assess what the Democrats can do to stop Trump from choosing from his list of conservative ideologues now that Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has ignored Schumer's call for the Republican Senate to adhere to the rule they came up with in denying Merrick Garland a hearing, that Supreme Court nominees should not get a confirmation vote in election years. Then we will examine the genesis of today's Janus versus AFSCME ruling by the Supreme Court against public employee unions, which both weakens unions and diminishes their ability to fund Democratic campaigns and candidates. Mary Batari, the Deputy Director of the Center for Media and Democracy, where she has an article, Trump's Supreme Court Strikes Blow to Government Workers, Good-Paying Jobs, joins us to discuss how a network of right-wing front groups funded by billionaires in league with the Federalist Society find plaintiffs like Mark Janus, who they use to build a right-to-work case around and fast-track it through the courts to further the interests of anti-union plutocrats, all in the name of free speech and the First Amendment. Then finally, we will look into yesterday's Supreme Court 5-4 ruling upholding Trump's Muslim ban, which will give the president enormous authority to pursue his anti-immigrant policies on the southern border. Elizabeth Goitein, the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, joins us to discuss how the court's conservative majority refused to consider mountainous evidence of Trump's racist statements and biased attitudes as they handed him absolute authority over immigration policy. And joining us now is Nancy Combs, who is the Ernest W. Goodrich Professor of Law and Director of the Human Security Law Center at William & Mary Law School. She has written extensively on international law and international criminal justice, and she served as a law clerk for Justice Anthony Kennedy on the United States Supreme Court. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nancy Combs.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted.
Well, thank you, Nancy. And what do you make of the announcement today of the retirement of Anthony Kennedy? Not entirely a surprise. I think he's in his early 80s. Mm-hmm. But the consequences are pretty huge, are they not? I mean, the Senate Minority Leader, Chuck Schumer, said today that Kennedy's leaving is the most important Supreme Court vacancy for this country in at least a generation. What would you say?
Oh, I would agree and then some. It is nothing short of cataclysmic. Justice Kennedy has held a pivotal role for the last. He's been on the court for 3 decades, and for basically that whole time he has been the center. He has provided the kind of guidance that the Supreme Court, I think, has desperately needed to retain credibility, particularly as the country has become more polarized in recent years. And so his retirement is truly a transitional, a transformative time for Supreme Court jurisprudence.
And, of course, when the Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, as I quoted him, he went on to say today that he asked his Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, to follow the rule that they set in 2016, not to consider a Supreme Court justice in an election year, of course, referring to Obama's nominee Merrick Garland, who did not get a hearing based upon McConnell's insistence that they refuse to hold hearings in an election year. So, obviously, Schumer was trying to turn the tables, but to no avail. The Senate Majority Leader made it clear that they want to fast-track a vote, and President Trump again today said that they want to get a new Supreme Court justice seated by the fall. So what's your sense of the political hardball here? What kind of tools do the Democrats have?
Well, unfortunately, I think their tools are quite limited. I think there's going to be a tremendous amount of verbal warfare, and I assume the Democrats are going to be using this issue to really try to get out the vote in November, as I think the Republicans did back in 2016. I think that was an awful lot of what was going on then. Obviously, they wanted to retain the Supreme Court vacancy for a Republican candidate if one were elected, but I think it was also a tool to get Republicans to the poll to show that something, you know, particularly the Republican base has been very intent on the Supreme Court for many years, and so this was a tremendous tool to bring out the vote in November, and I think the Democrats will do the same. But in terms of actually being able to prevent President Trump from nominating a conservative justice and having that justice confirmed, I think the Democrats' tools are quite limited.
So does this all go back then to the Merrick Garland situation in that last year where President Obama almost had a whole year and Mitch McConnell prevented a hearing and Merrick Garland twisted in the wind? And now we know since these recent flurry of rulings as the Supreme Court year closed out, it was pretty clear that the 5-4 majority was key and that Gorsuch was key in those rulings. Do you think, going back to that moment, do you think there was anything that the Democrats could have done? Because, frankly, in retrospect, I'm sure they're wondering what they could have done. Because, frankly, I think they probably thought that Hillary Clinton was going to win, so they were prepared to take a hit. But it turned out to be...
I think that's exactly, yes. I think you have it exactly right. I think Clinton's chances look so strong. I don't think they made as much of the issue as they might have. I also think, at some level, it was such an outrageous play by the Republicans. It was so clearly contrary to the rules, as it were, that I think to some extent, maybe I'm wrong about this, I assume it took the Democrats somewhat by surprise. For those of us not in the Senate, it took us by surprise. And I think you're right that Clinton's chances look so strong that it just seemed like, well, we might as well ride this out. I do think the Democrats probably should have highlighted the issue just as the Republicans did in order to get out the vote a little bit better. We can debate endlessly the many things that the Democrats could have, should have done, you know, for the 2016 election. That will be one for the generations. But I do think that they probably did not highlight for the population in general just the outrageousness of this action and, you know, the long-term consequences. I mean, as you said at the outset, Justice Kennedy's retirement, nobody knew exactly when it was going to be, but it can't have been a surprise that it was probably going to come during the Trump presidency or during, you know, the presidency of whoever won in 2016. So it was obviously a very important point to emphasize during the election.
And again, I'm speaking with Nancy Combs, who is the Ernest W. Goodrich Professor of Law and Director of the Human Security Law Center at William & Mary Law School. She has written extensively on international law and international criminal justice, and she served as a law clerk to Justice Anthony Kennedy on the United States Supreme Court. So Justice Kennedy was a reliably conservative vote, but he did join with the liberal minority in supporting abortion rights, same-sex marriage, and affirmative action, among others. So give us a sense of how he got these credentials as a swing vote, and particularly in the context of the most recent rulings where he seemed to sort of hew back to the conservative side.
Yeah, and I think if you look over his 31 years, you will see, I think you're right, that history will judge him as a conservative justice overall. And I think that historical judgment would be even more true had the country not become as polarized as it has. At the same time, I think one of the reasons that Justice Kennedy has been so often labeled a swing vote is because of his judicial independence. You're right that in many cases, and particularly lately, he has voted with the conservative wing of the Supreme Court. But you always knew when you came before Justice Kennedy that he was going to look at the facts of the case, he was going to deeply consider the merits of each and every case, and that, you know, facts mattered, the human consequences mattered. And so you could not reliably predict how he was going to rule in a particular case. He was not ideologically committed in the way that some of the justices are. For that reason alone, I think he would have, you know, garnered the label swing justice.
But do you think, though, he's a sort of example of what many analysts see as a kind of almost extinct species, and that is the kind of moderate, traditional Republican, Main Street, conservative on economics, but reasonably tolerant and liberal on social matters?
Are you asking whether I think that breed is extinct? You know, what's interesting to me, and I'm not going to tell you I'm an expert on this, is that I think Justice Kennedy and his approach really appeals to a broad swath of the American public, far more than some of the more extreme elements that we see in Congress right now and who seem to be being voted in with some regularity. I think if you look at, you know, just a large portion of our population, they would find both his views and his values to be very, very attractive. And by values, I mean he really emphasized the dignity of every human being, the ideals of the country, the, you know, liberty, justice. I mean, in some sense, if you ever saw him give a speech, he was extraordinarily idealistic about the values upon which the United States was founded. Idealistic in a sense that now might seem a little bit quaint or outmoded. And so I do think if you look at the politicians that we are electing these days, he does seem to be, you know, something of an extinct, dying species. But if you look at a lot of Americans, I think they would find his views very, very attractive.
Well, but when you say naive, that's one of the criticisms of his opinion in the Tectonic case of Citizens United, where he said, you know, that obviously we'll have transparency, we'll have disclosure. This is not going to be all about dark money in secret being donated from God knows where and God knows who, which is the situation we have now. And so do you think he was a little naive in his belief that somehow by opening the floodgates of money that somehow you could also have transparency?
Yeah, you said naive, I said idealistic. I can't say, I've certainly read those commentaries as well. I don't feel I'm not a First Amendment expert or particularly well-informed about campaign contributions and that, so I'm not feeling all that capable of opining about it, but I've certainly read the kind of criticisms that you've identified, and they do seem reasonably based to me. So it is true, I think that's probably true of most people who are very idealistic about values. I mean, I think we need that sort of optimism in order to move forward, but the real world doesn't always conform to it, and at times when it doesn't, that optimism can appear to be naive.
And is he similar in terms of his legacy and certainly his positions to Sandra Day O'Connor? They always seem to me to be somewhat two peas in a pod.
Yeah, certainly others have made that comparison. And when I clerked, Justice O'Connor was also on the court. And one could certainly, I can't say I knew how she deliberated, you know, because each chambers is, you know, runs its own way and is fairly closed to outsiders. But I do think there is, in both of them, there was a sense of dealing with each case as it came, rather than starting from a preordained position and reasoning deductively therefrom. certainly, I think both of them did, you know, their jurisprudence might seem less consistent than, say, a Scalia or even, you know, some of the more liberal justices. But I think that came from recognizing that, or at least in Justice Kennedy's case, I don't want to speak to Justice O'Connor as much, in Justice Kennedy's case, I think he has been committed to a number of ideals, and these ideals will come into conflict in different cases. And so that his commitments will lead him to different places in different cases. And they're not, and it's just not as predictable as some of the other justices who start from more, as I say, sort of first principles, if you will. But yes, I agree that he and Justice O'Connor, certainly bear more similarity than Justice Kennedy does to some other members of the court, including other members of the court with whom he votes quite regularly.
Well, it doesn't seem likely, though, that we're going to have anybody from that, what I was referring to as a kind of an almost extinct species, given the polarization. And already President Trump said that he would choose a replacement for Justice Kennedy from his list of 25, the same list that he chose Gorsuch from. And Senator Kamala Harris dismissed that, said this list is a complete non-starters. They are conservative ideologues, not mainstream jurists. We cannot and will not accept them to serve on the highest court in the land. That may be brave words, but I think the reality is that Trump, the old expression, a good prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich. In this case, do you think this president could put anybody on the court he wanted to in this current mood?
That is an excellent question. I think an awful lot is going to depend. There are some centrists still in the Senate, both Republicans and Democrats, and I think a lot is going to depend on them. I think if he were to go ahead, I mean, Gorsuch proved although Justice Gorsuch was widely understood to be very conservative, very ideologically committed to conservative values, he also came with a kind of pedigree that few people could argue with. He obviously is highly intelligent, extraordinarily well-educated, and had the kind of experience that nobody could contest. And so I think if President Trump were to appoint somebody in that mold, it would be difficult to argue against them. Now, at the same time, I think the stakes are so much higher now. Replacing just a Justice Scalia with a Justice Gorsuch certainly upset the Democrats extraordinarily, because they feel the position, the spot was stolen from them. But they also realized that it didn't actually change the ideological complexion of the Supreme Court, because Justice Scalia was already so conservative. Now, with potentially, the overturning of Roe versus Wade, with just dramatically different results that may result from this confirmation, I think everything is up for grabs. Do I think President Trump could appoint, is he going to be able to get just anybody through? I don't know why he would want to. To my mind, what he would want to do is appoint somebody in the mold of Justice Gorsuch. He will get the results that he and his base want without, and there's plenty of people out there on that list of 25 who have those kind of credentials. I don't think he has to push the boundaries too far to make his base very happy and achieve the results he'd like to achieve.
Well, Nancy Combs, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Nancy Combs, who is the Ernest W. Goodrich Professor of Law and Director of the Human Security Law Center at William & Mary Law School. She has written extensively on international law and international criminal justice, and she served as a law clerk to Justice Anthony Kennedy on the United States Supreme Court. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the genesis of today's Janus versus Aspe ruling by the Supreme Court against public employee unions, which both weakens unions and diminishes their ability to fund Democratic campaigns and candidates.
Here comes the dollar. Here comes the dollar. Here comes the dollar.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mary Batari, who's the Deputy Director of the Center for Media and Democracy. She helped launch the Center for Media and Democracy's award-winning ALEC Exposed investigation and has spearheaded CMD's work on the financial crisis and the painfully slow recovery. And she says an article at the Center for Media and Democracy, Trump's Supreme Court Strikes Blow to Government Workers, Good-Paying Jobs. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mary Batari.
Thank you for having me.
And Mary, you've sort of traced the sort of genesis of the case that was ruled on today, Janus versus AFSCME, in which the court ruled 5-4 in favor of this fellow Janus, who is a state worker in Illinois and a childcare worker. But he just wasn't some guy, the little guy who came out of nowhere and had this great victory. This whole thing was orchestrated. I mean, you've done the work now for some time on tracking the groups behind this decision. So can you walk us through it?
Yes, you put your finger on it right away. I mean, Mark Janus, a sympathetic child support worker in Illinois, never even had a case. The case was originally brought by Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner, who, as you know, is a billionaire venture capitalist, as sort of a blood oath against the union in his state, Illinois AFSCME. The original case was Rauner v. AFSCME. And when Rauner was found not to have standing, the savvy lawyers whipped in this guy, Mark Janus, to be a more sympathetic face for this issue. But this is part and parcel of a sprint that has occurred in the last decade to do two things. One is in the red states, ALEC legislators would grab ALEC model bills called things like right to work and paycheck protection, and they would basically force them through the state legislature to dismantle unions in their state. And that happened in a lot of red states. And in blue states, including California, which is the origin of many of these lawsuits, they pursued a different strategy. These same foundations, these same billionaire backers, pursued a strategy of bringing lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit to chip away at the union rights in those states. So these are instances where it's not the little guy rising up to bring a suit, but it's people being actually courted and cultivated to bring these anti-union suits in blue states.
And in this blue state of California, of course, the previous case was Friedrichs versus California Teachers Federation. And that, again, was ginned up. It did get to the Supreme Court, but at the time after Supreme Court Justice Scalia had died, and that was a 4-4 decision. But the fact that they came back with Janus would indicate to me that this is almost like a production line, right?
It is almost like a production line. And you see the same players and the same institutions and the same lawyers from the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation bringing these cases. This term, we have just had two devastating 5-4 decisions, two decisions that could have easily gone the other way, but for the sabotage of the appointment of President Obama's pick for the Supreme Court, Merrick Garland. We had a case called the EPIC Systems case that will negatively impact all private sector, non-union workers. They'll all be forced into arbitration now over issues like wage theft. They can no longer sue over wage theft. They're going to be forced into arbitration. And now we have this Janus case, which is a very significant blow against government workers of all stripes, nurses, you know, cops, firefighters, all sorts of government workers in good-paying government jobs.
Well, I think it'll particularly have a very negative impact on the attempts by teachers' unions to protect teaching and public schools from this enormously well-funded onslaught by a bunch of sort of meddling billionaires backing charter schools. We just had one on the ballot here in California, and they backed Villaraigosa with a lot of money. Fortunately, he lost. But the fact that these charter school backers have so much money, again, they're going to come back. And if the teachers' union, which are the people fighting back against charter schools, if they're defunded by Janus, which is what the intention appears to be, then this will be a blow for public education and a win for the charter school movement.
That's a very, very important point. I interviewed Harvard professor Theda Scotchbull, who told me that teachers are at the heart of all this, that the billionaires who back these cases, like the Koch brothers and the billionaire Bradley Foundation, represent a form of ultra-conservatism that's geared towards making sure that there is no organized power outside of big business and the wealthy. And she points to the fact that teachers exist in every community across America, and they are smart, articulate, well-spoken people who advocate for schools and kids. And these same billionaires are the billionaires, you know, advocating for the privatization of the school system. The Bradley Foundation, for instance, has dedicated its life to privatizing the public school system, and the Koch brothers have as well, working through institutions like the American Legislative Exchange Council. So this is a very significant blow to teachers and to public education and to public services in general in America.
And again, I'm speaking with Mary Petare, who is the Deputy Director of the Center for Media and Democracy. She helped launch the Center for Media and Democracy's award-winning ALEC Exposed investigation and has spearheaded CMD's work on the financial crisis and the painfully slow recovery. And she has an article at the Center for Media and Democracy, Trump's Supreme Court Strikes Blow to Government Workers' Good-Paying Jobs. Now, Gorsuch, of course, essentially auditioned for the Supreme Court by his ruling in the so-called frozen truck driver case, where a truck driver in the dead of winter, his rig broke down. He had a choice to either stay with the rig and freeze to death or go seek help. And he did the latter, and Gorsuch ruled against him in a very conspicuous way that got the attention of the Federalist Society, a fellow called Leonard Leo, who's had an enormous effect on getting these rulings through the Supreme Court. It's known as Supreme Court shopping. So they're all in league, aren't they? I mean, Leonard Leo will be choosing the next Gorsuch for Donald Trump, I assume.
Yes, Leonard Leo is a very powerful figure in American politics that most Americans will never hear of or have never heard of. He has worked hand in glove with the same groups that I'm mentioning. The Bradley Foundation here in Milwaukee has long funded the Federalist Society. In fact, they think that they founded the Federalist Society. And they have systematically backed a national infrastructure, both national groups like the Federalist Society and state-based think tanks, state-based litigation centers, to bring these kinds of cases. This is a very extremist ideology and a very extremist group of people. They don't go out in public and talk about their, you know, their cases the way they talk about them behind the scenes. In public, they might say that they're trying to end, you know, coerced unionization, they may call it, or forced unionization. But behind the scenes, they reveal a real bare-knuckled agenda of basically striking a blow against a major funder of the Democratic Party, striking a blow to defund and defang unions. And so we got a number of these secret documents. We got a hold of a union-busting toolkit that had been produced by the State Policy Network, which is part of this consortium of foundations and think tanks working on this. And that's why we wrote an article called The Two Faces of Janus, The Two Faces of the Janus Case, the public face and the private face that they reveal in secret documents behind closed doors.
Yes, but aren't they coaching these plaintiffs like Janus and Friedrichs to appear to be pro-union, so to disguise what the real intent of the billionaire backers is?
Yes, these are very carefully cultivated clients. They're very polished. They give the same, you know, rely on the same talking points over and over again. Mark Janus likes to talk about being a Boy Scout, and Rebecca Friedrichs, who was the lead plaintiff in the Friedrichs case against the California Teachers Association, you know, is very perky and talks about what a great public school teacher she is and how much she cares about kids. But the reality is that these people are lending their face to a very nasty, very long-term agenda, a sort of scorched earth agenda that's being implemented by wealthy, powerful foundations, corporations, and individuals.
But this ruling today, the Janus versus AFSCME, the origins, of course, go back to the 41-year-old Supreme Court decision, which legalized the very fees, union fees, that are now being have been challenged and successfully. And now, in effect, what's happened is that prior to Janus, the issue was opting out of the union. But now this Supreme Court decision has reversed the tables, if you will, or turned them upside down. And now it's all about opting in, because the unions are going to have to convince all of their members to pay dues. That's how radical this ruling is. But the foundational ruling, Abood versus Detroit Board of Education, it segregated the union fees for getting you better working conditions, better wages and conditions from what the union does in terms of its political spending. So this whole case, to my mind, is just ginned up nonsense. There's no real foundation to it. And the idea that it's, again, rests on a First Amendment interpretation, that somehow this guy, Mark Janus's First Amendment rights were infringed upon when the Abood case dealt with that.
Right. The right to organize a union, the right to freedom of association for people to come together to form a union is an internationally recognized human right. And some unions use agency fees, some do not. But the Abood case tried to strike a balance between the rights of unions to exist and advocate for their workers and be robust, and the rights of individual members of that union to actually not be a member of that union if they wanted to opt out. But they still were benefited from collective bargaining, so maybe they should pay some fees. So that's why they're called fair share fees. So Abood was trying to strike a balance. This new court, with Neil Gorsuch being the deciding vote, is swinging it all the way in one direction, and that's the anti-worker direction. One of the experts I talked to said it was a concerted corporate-funded effort to get rid of public employee unions, to stop them from advocating for higher minimum wages, affordable health care, the right to paid sick leave, and all those things that benefit all of us, not just union members.
And also fund the Democratic Party. I mean, that's ultimately, this is where I wonder whether these gentlemen in robes are just really partisan politicians dressed up in judicial robes. Because, first of all, in all of these confirmation hearings, with going back to Roberts and Alito and Gorsuch, nobody ever asks them, are you a corporatist? Because all of these, it's always questions about abortion and all these other extraneous issues, but never about your corporatist bias. And if you look at the law in the broader sense, you know, you've got an awful lot of people in the law involved in corporate who do corporate law, and there's a minority of lawyers who do public interest law. Is there anybody on the Supreme Court who has a background in public interest law? But I think most of them have a background in corporate law, do they not?
I think that that's probably true. I'm not as familiar with the bios of these justices. But, you know, Justice Kagan spoke out in her dissent, which I really encourage people to read. You can find the decision at the SCOTUS blog or on our website, Exposed by CMB. And she just blew the First Amendment arguments out of the water. She said the court was weaponizing the First Amendment, basically weaponizing it against working families. And I just thought that was the perfect term for what's going on here. And she systematically addressed every one of their arguments and just dismantled it. Unions are required by law and still required by law to represent everyone. And so as a consequence, everyone should be paying their fees for that type of representation. And to allow a sector of those people to drop out, you know, is going to be a significant blow to unions. Just like if I was given the option not to pay my taxes, I might consider not paying my taxes. Or if I was, you know, a lawyer given the option not to pay my mandatory bar fees, maybe I wouldn't pay my mandatory bar fees. But only in this area, only in the area of unionization, union rights, is this a crisis that must be addressed by the court. They're not so worried about lawyers being forced to pay their bar fees, are they?
Well, you know, this has a potential for, as bad as these rulings are, and there was this expectation or this assumption that Justice Kennedy was the swing vote, although he's been voting with the hard right majority lately. He just retired with another Gorsuch appointed by Trump. Obviously, things are going to get infinitely worse than they are now, as bad as they are now. A 6-3 ruling on, I mean, I don't know whether you read Justice Kennedy's letter to Donald Trump, but he called him my dear Mr. President. Don't they get who this guy is? I mean, it's unbelievable that they talk about stare decisis. That's how, remember Roberts in his confirmations, that all he talked about, with the idea that, you know, you don't mess with settled law. Well, my God, they're ripping settled law up right, left and center.
Yeah, talk about stare decisis. They're overturning the laws of 22 states. They're overturning thousands. And I don't know if we even have a number, but thousands, perhaps tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of contracts at the state and municipal and local level. They're just overturning these contracts. The city of New York alone will have to renegotiate 144 contracts, like, immediately. So this is, Justice Kagan kept pointing this out. She kept going in oral arguments. She said, when have we ever done this? What is the justification for doing this? She said over and over again. And today, Alito attempted to present that justification, but I think that history will judge him harshly for it.
Well, just in closing, it seems to me that what's really going on here is that this is the white man's party, the GOP, their last hurrah. They're obviously afraid that they're on the wrong side of the demographic changes, and rather than embrace minorities under Trump, they're insulting them. And so their idea to have the minority white party, the GOP, maintain its majority status is through more gerrymandering, through voter suppression, and through defunding the Democrats. And all of the recent rulings that have come out in the last few days all contribute to that.
Right. That's exactly right. And we have been at CMD, we have been involved in the Wisconsin gerrymandering case. It's a case about partisan gerrymandering, not racial gerrymandering. We filed an amicus brief in the case because Wisconsin was gerrymandered with a huge skew. It would be, they did a very high-tech, computer-driven gerrymander of the state of Wisconsin that really represented very clear issues of abuse of the process. And that case is now very difficult without Kennedy. Kennedy was the person who was the strongest on the issue of partisan gerrymandering, and now he's gone. So these cases were remanded back to the states, but the person that most of the states were relying on to potentially give them relief in that case is now gone.
Well, Mary Bottari, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Mary Bottari, who's the Deputy Director of the Center for Media and Democracy. She helped launch the Center for Media and Democracy's award-winning ALEC Exposed investigation and has spearheaded CMD's work on the financial crisis and the painfully slow recovery. And she has an article at the Center for Media and Democracy, Trump's Supreme Court Strikes Blow to Government Workers' Good-Paying Jobs. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into yesterday's Supreme Court 5-4 ruling upholding Trump's Muslim ban.
I work for the union, 'cause she's so good to me, and I'm bound to come out on top. That's where she said I should be. I will hear every word the boss may say, for he's the one who hands me down my pay.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Elizabeth Goitein, the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, which seeks to advance effective national security policies that respect constitutional values and the rule of law. Previously, she served as counsel to Senator Feingold, chairman of the Constitutional Subcommittee of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a trial attorney in the Federal Programs Branch of the Civil Division of the Department of Justice. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Goitein.
Thanks very much for having me.
And it's pretty hard to keep up with these, obviously, this flurry of rulings coming from the Supreme Court, one after the other. And obviously, I want to talk to you about the Muslim ban ruling. But since then, of course, we've had the Janus ruling, which began to eviscerate public employees' unions and in substantially defund the Democratic Party. That's pretty radical. And then on top of that, of course, Justice Kennedy, the so-called swing vote on the Supreme Court, has just announced his retirement. So let's look at the big picture here. Do you think, as much as these recent rulings have given progressives heartburn, with another Neil Gorsuch appointed by Donald Trump, surely the Supreme Court will go further to the right?
Yeah, I think that's a safe assumption. I think this is going to be, obviously, whoever is nominated to replace Justice Kennedy, there's going to be, I think, a massive confirmation fight. And, I mean, Justice Kennedy, yes, he has sided with the conservatives in several of the rulings that have come out recently. I think, actually, his concurrence in the Muslim ban decision was particularly disappointing. In that concurrence, he basically said, well, there's nothing we can do. The court can't get involved here. But, you know, the president really should just adhere to the Constitution on his own without us having to tell him to do so. I mean, come on, that's not going to get you very far. But certainly over the years, Kennedy has been a very key swing vote in a lot of cases. He is not known to be, you know, a solid vote in the conservative bloc. And so, there's every reason to think going forward that the court is going to drift further and further to the right.
But when you say this will lead to a big confirmation fight, surely the fight that should have taken place was the Merrick Garland one. I mean, when you look back on that, which was such a flagrant abuse or denial of a president's right to make an appointment, as though the president only has a 3-year term, not a 4-year term. Do you think something could have been done back then? Because now I don't see the votes. It's not a question of a filibuster, is it? It's a simple majority vote.
Yeah, I mean, in retrospect, I think that the Democrats should have pushed much, much harder on Merrick Garland. I think there was an assumption that Hillary Clinton would win the election, and so it wasn't necessary to sort of pull out all the stops on that fight, and clearly that turned out to be a miscalculation. It was unprecedented and completely beyond the pale for the Republicans in Congress to block a vote on Merrick Garland. And, that fight should have been fought. But we're that was then, and we have to now think about the future and how, you know, what we can do to try to ensure that the court doesn't veer entirely off course.
Well, but what can the Democrats do? Is there any tools in their toolbox that somehow I'm overlooking? They just don't have the votes, do they?
Well, I think one of the things that's happening right now is that people in Congress are looking to see essentially which of the sort of practices that have been in place when it comes to judicial confirmations and other sort of procedural issues are in fact sort of unmovable and sort of solidified in the rules versus ones that are really just norms that have been solidified into place just because of long usage. And so, you know, the notion that nothing can come to the floor unless the majority leader says it can come to the floor, that actually turns out to be more norm-based than rule-based. But then the question is, what are the costs of revisiting some of these norms? So I think there's going to be a lot of discussion that goes on the Hill about what is wise, what is sort of in the long-term interests of our democracy when it comes to this particular judicial battle.
Well, if you want to talk about norms, we have a president that's broken more norms than I think anybody in history and continues to do so. So
that's absolutely right. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the right response is for those who are in opposition to the president's policies and his norm breaking to go breaking their own norms. So, I mean, that's why this is something that just requires a lot of thought and strategy.
And again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Goitein, the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, which seeks to advance effective national security policies that respect constitutional values and the rule of law. And previously she served as counsel to Senator Feingold, chairman of the Constitution Subcommittee of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a trial attorney in the Federal Programs Branch of the Civil Division of the Department of Justice. So let's turn to yesterday's ruling, upholding the Muslim ban. And of course, right off the top, it does seem a little inconsistent in terms of the countries from which people were being banned in to entering the United States. Obviously, they'd put North Korea in so that it wouldn't be entirely Muslim countries, and Venezuela. But obviously, there's not a huge tourist trade with North Korea at the moment. So I don't imagine there's too many visas at risk there. But what about the idea that, for example, Saudi Arabia, 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia, they've spread their extremely anti-Western version of Islam around the world, Wahhabism, and yet they're not included in the Muslim ban. So on the surface, I'm not sure this is more political in terms of foreign policy choices than it is there's any kind of legal consistency. How do you see it?
Well, I think so. The court didn't get into anywhere near, or at least the majority didn't get into anywhere near that level of sort of analysis, precisely because the majority said, well, we can't look too closely at this policy. You know, I think, yes, it's certainly revealing about the policy and about the motives for the policy that nations like Saudi Arabia were excluded from the Muslim ban. I think what we see from this is that essentially, you know, this is an effort, was an effort to restrict the entry of Muslims into the country while excluding those countries that we felt that we had to exclude because we're doing business with them in some way. And I think I would put Iraq on that list as well. So it really is religious animus shaded by self-interest. But that's obviously not what the majority of the court ruled, because essentially, among other things, the majority said, you know, this is national security, this is immigration, therefore we pretty much have to more or less accept whatever the president tells us about this Muslim ban. We can't look too hard behind it.
So this is then, is this a blank check to Trump? Because doesn't this embolden and empower him on the southern border as well? In terms of
I think that's a really important concern. The majority opinion sets a very dangerous precedent in terms of judicial kowtowing to the president in any matter involving immigration or national security, even if the matter also involves individual rights. And yes, it's true that executive branch judgments in certain areas like foreign affairs and national security and immigration are entitled to some deference, but that's never a blank check. And the calculus changes, or it should change, when individual liberties are at stake, because it is the courts, not the executive branch or Congress, that are best positioned to protect individual liberties. So I think it's very worrisome, the approach that was taken in the majority opinion.
Well, in some of his pretty incendiary rhetoric, blaming the Democrats and suggesting that they want MS-13 gang members to come into the United States so that they'll vote Democrat and cause mayhem and infest this country. And one of the things that he threw out the other day, which didn't get a lot of attention, was, and he said, and of course, on the southern border, you've got these people coming in from the Middle East with children, pretending that these children are theirs. That was a clear reference to the possibility of terrorism. At least I can't see any other interpretation of what he's saying. My understanding is that there's never, ever been in many, many decades, if not forever, any, maybe go back to the Zimmerman telegram in World War I, but as far as I know, no terrorist has ever been caught on the southern border infiltrating this country. So what do you think President Trump was getting at with that remark?
Yeah, I think I think that was probably in line with his comments that 3 million immigrants, undocumented immigrants, voted illegally in the 2016 election, or his comments that that the crowd at his inauguration was the largest crowd ever. It appears to have been fabricated entirely out of whole cloth. It puts me in mind of a comment that his former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, made about having personally seen signs posted at the border in Arabic directing terrorists which way to go. I mean, gosh, I would love to see a photograph of one of those signs. I mean, this is the height of irresponsibility to just make up these facts in order to justify. But the problem is that with the Muslim ban decision is that when the executive branch makes up facts or in other ways sort of cobbles together a sort of paper-thin factual rationalization for discriminatory policies, if the court refuses to take a hard look or really any kind of a look at that justification, then we're going to see a lot of constitutionally completely impermissible actions by the administration getting a free pass by the courts.
And giving Donald Trump a blank check, as the Supreme Court did, and not wanting to get into the details, which is pretty extraordinary. Now, on the one hand, you can argue that maybe they should give Trump a pass for what he said on the campaign trail, because politicians don't necessarily adhere to the promises they make. But when you look at Trump and his rhetorical record and what he said and done over the years, going back to discriminating against African Americans in housing, all the way through to launching his campaign calling Mexicans rapists and murderers, is there any way that you can make that case? Did anybody make that case to the justices that we may well have a racist president?
Well, certainly the case was made that the policy itself was based on racial animus, or at least I should say religious animus against Muslims. That case was made powerfully. That evidence was presented. Justice Sotomayor wrote just a very compelling dissent in which she laid out all of that evidence, because Justice Roberts, in his majority opinion, had sort of noted a few of the comments and then said essentially, but they're irrelevant to my analysis. And Justice Sotomayor said, wait a minute, let's look at all of these comments. And then she said, you know, they are the opposite of irrelevant. They demonstrate, any reasonable observer would conclude, that this policy was based on, the reason for this policy was anti-Muslim animus. And that is impermissible under the First Amendment, end of story. The only way that the majority was able to hold otherwise was by completely ignoring those statements and focusing only on the government's evidence, which was really remarkable. I mean, the majority did, in fact, look beyond the four corners of the Muslim ban itself. It said, we're going to look at extrinsic evidence. But then it only looked at the government's evidence, which was essentially the existence of this worldwide review that several agencies supposedly performed in order to identify immigration threats. And, you know, that kind of evidence, which I think was rebutted fairly well by the plaintiffs. But in any case, the court looked at that, but the court did not look at, the majority did not look at these anti-Muslim statements at all when performing its review.
Well, there's a kind of Orwellian quality to some of the recent flurry of rulings. The one that didn't get much attention out here in California, where they struck down a California law requiring these religious organizations that put up shingles saying that they're for reproductive rights and abortion counseling, etc., when in fact they don't counsel for abortion. They basically try to get the women, pregnant women, to go ahead and have the child, and regardless of who takes care of it, that they're driven by their religious beliefs. But the court deferred to the religious beliefs of these people in terms of free speech, and yet what they are engaged in is censorship because they don't provide a full menu of information.
Well, we also saw the Supreme Court uphold the free speech rights of the cake bakers who did not want to bake a cake for, or at least the First Amendment rights, I should say, of the couple that did not want to bake a cake for the ceremony of a gay couple that was getting married, and you know, basically held that the state law that actually required the state decision requiring the bakery to make this cake was violated the First Amendment. But when it comes to the First Amendment rights of Americans whose relatives and friends and associates are trying to get visas to come into this country, they were really just ignored. I don't know how else to put it. It wasn't that the majority weighed the sort of evidence of anti-religious, anti-Muslim sentiments against some other kind of interest. The anti-religious statements that the president had made, the anti-Muslim statements, were entirely ignored in that context. It was very difficult to reconcile that with the sort of solicitude given to the First Amendment rights of people who do not want to bake cakes for gay couples or organizations that want to deny access to abortion services.
Well, just in closing, I think at the end of the day, isn't the Supreme Court decision, again, under the First Amendment, I guess it goes back a while, but the Citizens United, which cemented the idea that money is speech, that's essentially what's at play in the Janus ruling as well, isn't it?
I'll be honest, I have not had a chance today to fully unpack the Janus ruling as I've been very focused on the Muslim ban decision. But I definitely think that there's some very troubling First Amendment precedent that's being set out by this court.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Elizabeth Goitein. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Goitein, who is the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, which seeks to advance effective national security policies that respect constitutional values and the rule of law. Previously, she served as a counsel to Senator Feingold, chairman of the Constitutional Subcommittee of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a trial attorney in the Federal Programs Branch of the Civil Division of the Department of Justice. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Larivalat. This program's available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.